The COP30 climate conference held in Brazil has come to an end, prompting many questions around future climate action and Australia's role in the next COP summit, with Adelaide's hosting opportunity now off the table. Professor Matthew Harrison, climate resilience leader at the University of Tasmania, has also pointed to the summit's focus on funding adaptability rather than targeting mitigation efforts around fossil fuels. The Wire's Sam Giorgio spoke with Professor Harrison to hear more.
Probably one of the big pluses was the just transition mechanism, which is basically anchoring labour rights and human rights and the inclusion of marginalised groups to a low carbon economy. And this didn't really come about by chance. People have been pushing for this for a long time. So effectively what that does is it gets rich or developed countries to pay developing countries to adapt to the climate crisis. Things like rising sea levels and floods and adapting to areas with extreme heat and fire risk and that sort of thing. So that's a really good thing. And Brazil, as a sort of a sideline to COP30, Brazil launched what they call the Tropical Forests Forever Facility, which is basically a global investment fund for conservation and to prevent deforestation, which is also a good thing. The big negative is that the majority of the funding is towards adaptation. What that means is preventing sea level rise, preventing deforestation, adapting to heat waves, preventing extreme fires that you get with global warming. There's very little about mitigation. Mitigation means reducing CO2 emissions, reducing methane, reducing nitrous oxide. It's CO2 emissions that have contributed to the climate crisis in the first place. So effectively what they're doing is they're putting an ambulance at the bottom of the cliff rather than putting a fence at the top.
As you mentioned, the overall mitigation ambition was pretty weak, and some groups within the summit worked to prevent any reference to a transition from fossil fuels and inefficient fossil fuel subsidies. What's the significance of this?
If you boil it down, at its heart, you have this tension between economic growth and income and climate change mitigation. And that's because there's a strong coupling between productivity and greenhouse gas emissions. And it's difficult to decouple. You can, but it's difficult to do. If you reduce greenhouse gas emissions, it's very easy to reduce productivity. So oil-rich and coal-rich countries that get a lot of their income from fossil fuels, they pushed very hard to stop their phase out of fossil fuels because it's a large source of their income. So that was a big barrier, and there was 194 countries there, and only really 90 were strongly in support of phasing out fossil fuels. The others were a little bit ambiguous, and some of them were very strongly against phasing out coal, oil and gas. All of this climate finance is really aspirational rhetoric. It's not a pledge. It's not an obligation. The big issue is that the operational detail is very limited. So you have this plan or aspiration, which is all very well, like we're going to reduce global warming to 1.5 degrees, we're going to triple climate finance, which is good, but then you need to go back to your national government, to your state government, to your local councils to operationalise that detail. Otherwise, it's just a plan. The big failing of these COP sessions is that they fail to reflect. They do it in a little way, but they fail to reflect on what they said last year, what was actually done last year, and what was not done. And they don't really say, well, why was it not done? What could we do better? What did we say we would do last time? How do we fix that going forward? There's no reflection. It's more about aspirational rhetoric, which is a good thing to come together and have a plan, but you need that operational detail.
Professor Amy Cutter Mackenzie Knowles is Executive Dean of Faculty of Education at the Southern Cross University, underlined the COP30's position of education at the core of climate resilience. How important is education, especially in regards to disinformation on renewables?
Yeah, it's critically important, particularly the next generation, of workers, so things like schools and universities, because it's the children of today that will suffer the extreme climatic events of the future from the emissions that we've produced today. So education is critically important in letting people know what's actually contributing to climate change, what they can do to avoid it, what the implications of continuing in the way that we are will be. We have only one atmosphere. This is the issue. We have only one atmosphere, which is basically a big lot of gas that sort of connects all of the countries together. The problem is each country just pollutes that big space of gas, and because it's almost like a common good, a common property, everyone thinks that it's everyone else's problem. That's the big issue. Everyone has to play their part, and it's not insurmountable to become net zero. Every country should be really aiming to reduce their emissions, but education is important, but it needs to be coupled with other things like legislation, regulation, and institutional plans.
Rebecca Markey-Towler, research fellow at Melbourne Climate Futures, has raised concerns that COP30 is the first climate summit to formally acknowledge temperature goals in the Paris Agreement won't be achieved. What's your reaction to COP30 being the first climate summit to formally acknowledge that the temperature goal of the Paris Agreement will not be achieved by 2030 and instead changing it to 2035?
It's an alarming recognition of the fact that the world is currently not on track to keep global warming to those temperature goals in the Paris Agreement. So the fact that actually in this agreement we've seen recognition that the world is really not on track to be keeping warming to 1.5 degrees. And even at this point, countries' climate pledges, they were due back in February of this year. And still countries have failed to update their nationally determined contributions to reduce their emissions. So I think the agreement is a landmark in recognising that we're not on track and that more really needs to be done to keep that warming to 1.5 degrees and to limit that overshoot to as much as possible.
Arthur Wynne's former advisor to the COP28 presidency has also said that it was one of the most difficult ones that they've conducted, facing many political issues as well as extreme weather events. How do these events reflect on the previous climate summits and the future prospective climate summits, and how to work at the same time as these extreme events that are increased due to climate change?
The world at the moment is dealing with significant headwinds, not only from a climate perspective, but geopolitical headwinds are really strong. So this was a COP where President Trump and the United States were not present at the actual negotiations. And that's really shifting the tone of the negotiations as well, because the US leadership is now gone. There were some question marks over whether China would step up to fill that leadership role. So their action on climate change is really strong, but they didn't really necessarily take that leadership role that people expected them to in the negotiations. So we're really seeing a shift in terms of the dynamics at these negotiations, where we're also seeing a shift in terms of the action that is required in of itself. So it's quite complex working out, you know, there were 60,000 delegates at this conference. And so it's very complex dealing with all those different facets of climate change. It's not just about reducing our emissions. It's not just about stopping fossil fuel developments from going ahead. It's actually about providing adequate finance to countries. It's about how do we learn to adapt to these impacts of climate change? How do we make sure there's a just transition? How do we compensate people for loss and damage that is experienced by climate change? How do we deal with the impact that it's going to have on youth? What is the role of civil society in all of this? So I think the COP was incredibly complex.
The summit ended somewhat shakily, with many countries, especially from Latin America and the EU, unhappy with the final deal, but accepted it was at least going in the right direction. Do you believe that countries that attend this summit undermine it by attempting to restrict proper negotiations and mentions of topics that are scientifically backed causes of climate change, like fossil fuels?
There are certainly different negotiating blocks. And so whilst we don't have significant clarity or sometimes on who's part of those negotiating blocks, we've heard lots of reports that there are certain country groups for which things like fossil fuels, for example, are called a red line. So they're items in the agenda which they say that they will not be compromising on. So there are certainly stumbling blocks at these COPs in terms of countries taking entrenched positions, including to continue to exploit fossil fuels. That being said, though, I think the alternative to this process, where you don't have multilateralism, is also quite alarming. A global challenge like climate change requires, as the COP30 presidency says, a collective effort to continue to address these challenges. And it's not just as simple as saying climate change requires us to no longer exploit fossil fuels. There are other considerations in play, and countries have different priorities as well.
As Australia won't be the location for the next COP, even with Australia being given the vice presidency of the next one, do you believe the interests of Pacific nations that are struggling, like Fiji, will receive proper attention?
I think that for me is one of the real disappointments that came out of this COP. The fact that Australia and the Pacific were going to lead the COP negotiations for next year, that would have been a real landmark in terms of really listening to the moral voice of climate change. These small island developing states who are really at the forefront of climate change, and it should be really clear that we have a moral imperative to act, as well as many other reasons to act because of their unique vulnerability. I hope that in its co-presidency role that Australia will continue to advocate for those Pacific Island voices and really make them front and centre, because Australia has a real responsibility to make sure that we, as a huge fossil fuel exporter and consumer of fossil fuels, that we are doing as much as we can, given our privileged status, to help reduce the significant impacts on our developing country island neighbour states and actually make sure these Pacific voices are really heard. And these Pacific voices are so powerful.
Rebecca Markie-Towler, Research Fellow at Melbourne Climate Futures, speaking with The Wire's Sam Giorgio.